You are listening to Two Booked Up, a podcast about business and personal development books and the conversations they ignite. I'm Shelley Tonkin-Smith.
And I'm Rowena Mabbitt. Today on the Two Booked Up podcast, Shelley and I will continue our exploration of Gretchen Rubin's The Four Tendencies. We're going to be talking about how knowing our tendencies has helped us as parents and as human beings. As we do so, you'll learn how to harness the strengths of your tendency in daily life,
how knowing your tendency can support you in your relationship with your partner,
how knowing your tendency can support you as a parent.
And then we'll cover some tips to talk to your children in a way that appeals to their particular tendency, or better yet, appealing to all four tendencies at the same time.
And as a special one for you obligers, who primarily respond to the expectations and needs of others until they don't, we're going to talk about a phenomenon called obliger rebellion and how to deal with that.
We live in a world where we are constantly under pressure to get things done. But what makes us get things done? What makes us act or not act? In last week's episode, we discussed the book, The Four Tendencies by Gretchen Rubin. The book offered an answer to this question, why do we act? And the answer is not the same for all of us. Depending on how you respond to outer and inner expectations, you'll act or choose not to act. And that'll put you into one of four groups, an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or a rebel.
Now today, Shelley, we are getting practical and chatting about how knowing your tendency can support you in your family and your personal life, both as a partner and as a parent. So before we can have good relationships, we have to know ourselves. And that's really why we chose this book, because we wanted to bring attention to the theme of self and knowing oneself. Knowing your tendency, while just one aspect of your personality, can be really helpful in knowing yourself.
Yes, and what we want to focus on throughout this episode is how to harness the strengths of your tendency to be a better partner, parent, and human being. So I'll jump right in and talk about the strengths of my tendency, the rebel, because at first glance, rebels seem like difficult people to deal with because they resist both outer and inner expectations. So you might be wondering how I get anything done or how anyone can bear to live or work with me. Well, the answer is that as a rebel, I act not out of expectation, but out of identity. Whether that's to have this life of freedom as an entrepreneur, which is very appealing to me as a rebel, or to have this identity of being a calm homeschooling mom, or to be a loving partner, these are the kinds of things that cause me to take action. When I feel like I have to do something, I can get a bit petulant, to be honest. So I'm going to just take a simple example. My amazing husband does the dishes most nights. And then every now and then he'll ask me to do the dishes and I will be quite grumbly about it. But then some nights I'll just choose to do the dishes. And I think this comes from a place of identity of being a loving partner. I'm a loving partner. But it also feels like it's my choice. But Ro, can you just share a little bit more about how the Four Tendencies framework and knowing that you're an upholder has benefited you within your family dynamic?
Sure. So I guess this was actually one of the real benefits of the book, having an awareness of the tendencies for both myself, but also my family, and being able to communicate more effectively with them as a result. Plus, I guess having a better understanding of the strengths and challenges for each of us, which, when I remember, helps me interpret actions with, let's say, greater love and compassion. Now, on that note, one of the challenges as an upholder is that we don't always remember that others don't see the world the same way we do. So continuing that dishes example, we assume that because we'd finished the cycle by emptying the sink of dirty water, cleaning out the sink, drying and putting away the washed items and wiping down the counters, others would do the same. But no. And so because we make that assumption generally, that can actually cause friction between us upholders and pretty much everybody else who is of a different tendency. So I think I mentioned in our very first episode, as an upholder spouse and parent, I suspect I probably can be a bit annoying at times. So knowing this about myself has been a big benefit, and adjusting my expectations of my family accordingly, I think they appreciate that, but it's also meant I'm far less stressed and anxious.
I like that a lot. And I like what you said about interpreting your family's actions with greater love and compassion. Like, I think that's really important. And also to interpret your own actions with greater love and compassion, and to actually come at it from a much more positive stance, and to go, okay, this is actually tendency at play. I'd love to dive into the strengths of the upholder tendency. How have you harnessed the strengths of the upholder tendency?
Yeah, and you're right. There are certainly strengths associated with being an upholder. In the book, Gretchen, who is also an upholder, she shares that being highly organized, reliable, and feeling energized by getting things done are some of the big strengths of this tendency. And I'd have to agree. In our relationship, so between myself and my husband, probably the best examples of us harnessing my strengths are actually our family vacations. So together we might discuss where we're going to go, but it's really best if I've already done some research, mostly to appease my husband's questionable leanings. But once we've decided, he isn't all that fussed on the details or, you know, the routine or the planning or the bookings, whereas this is where upholder strengths shine. So I pull it all together. I do the research, I book the transport, the accommodation, and I've been known to book all the entry tickets as well. So there's a lot of work there. And most of the time, I really love that kind of process. Of, it gives me a real sense of achievement and accomplishment. But then as the vacation approaches, the husband and my boys, they get a little more interested, but often they are completely surprised. But in this way, I get to do things the way I like, which is big for an upholder. But also I get to show my love by utilizing and exploiting the strengths of my tendency. And so I feel like there are definitely upsides and strengths to your tendency.
Definitely. And just what I want to pick up there is that you differ from the obliger side in that you do this organizing for your holiday. Of course, you do love to see like the surprise of your kids and that kind of thing, but you get joy from it. You also want the control of it. And that's an upholder, whereas an obliger would be doing perhaps the same things, organizing the holiday, but their motivation for taking that action would be to meet the expectations of their family. Whereas I think from your side of things, it's like those feelings of accomplishment, that feeling of control, that like, I want to dictate what's going to happen. So it's so interesting. Yeah. Often the action is the same, but the reason for taking the action could be very, very different.
For sure. And I think you're right. There are strengths with all tendencies. And I think there are often interesting dynamics within partnerships. But speaking of like our spouses and our partnerships, how about you, Shelley? How has knowing that your husband is a questioner helped in your relationship?
Yes. So the questioner-rebel combo is an interesting one because we both don't respond well to outer expectations. And I think this is why we've both set up our own businesses so that we can work from home. And in the book, Gretchen says that questioners can fall into this trap of analysis paralysis, where they want to keep questioning everything and doing lots more research, and they never make a decision. But I've certainly found that Garen is a very decisive questioner. Once he's got his answers, he's like, boom, do it. And I think our combination has also helped us to forge our own path as a family, to be free to make our own traditions that work for our little family. And here I find that like I bring all my off the wall rebel ideas and then he supports me. But as long as I give him time to do some of his research or even just give him a moment to think about it, and then he's totally on my side. And that I think is a strength between that little combination. And I think it's because I know that he's a questioner. He knows that I'm a rebel. And then I know that I need to give him time to internalize something. And I think he's got to know my rebel nature so much so that now he's claimed the title of Rebel Emeritus because he thinks he's got some kind of lifetime qualification in the art of rebellion, as if. But seriously, I think that our relationship is all the better for knowing each other's tendencies.
I do love, Shelley, picking up on what you've just said, that you've been able to forge your own path as a family. And I think that's definitely one of the real benefits of knowing the tendency that and the question at rebel combination is that you've been able to be in a position where you can do that. So I'm wondering, it might be a good point for us to have a little consideration or chat about how the four tendencies have influenced your parenting. And whilst I know schooling doesn't necessarily equate to parenting, it does seem like your rebel tendency and Garen's questioner tendency might have contributed to your decision to homeschool your kids. Would that be fair or accurate?
Oh, yes, I think that did play a big role because the fact is that we hadn't even considered homeschooling until we did. And then once we'd done a bit of research or quite a lot of research, but in a short amount of time, and we had answers to both of our questions, then that choice for our specific family was so clear. And it was homeschooling. And I think if we were more responsive to outer expectations, it would have been a bit more of a difficult decision and we would have taken longer to make the move. But then once we had clarity, we actually brought our decision forward rather than we didn't even complete the school term, which I'm guessing an upholder might have done. They would have gone, okay, it's logical to, you know, complete the school term. But we decided our decision is made, we're going for it. And that actually worked out well for us because we went into lockdown 3 weeks after we decided to homeschool. So like it was really good that we'd made the decision when we did. And by the way, I really don't think you have to be a rebel or a questioner to homeschool. One of the homeschoolers I follow is Pam Barnhill, and she must be an upholder. She's such an inspiration. And I can also imagine that there's going to be many homeschooling parents who are obligers and who've chosen homeschooling because they're doing it in service of the unique and special needs of their kids. So just like with careers, I don't think you need to pigeonhole your educational choices according to your tendency, but I do think it affects why you act and then the reasons behind your choices. So Ro, your boys are in mainstream school and traditional school, and I know that you're very involved in supporting them in all their extracurricular activities. Can you tell us a bit more about how knowing your tendency has influenced the way you parent your kids?
Yeah. So knowing my tendency has supported me as a parent, like I've shared a little bit about how it supports me as a spouse and some of the communications, but it also, it basically comes down to having a greater understanding and awareness that not everybody in my family works the same way as me. There's a quote that Gretchen shares in the book from another upholder, and it was just like she was in my head. So the quote reads, "Why can't anybody in this family get their own done?" And I completely get that. That is completely me, and it especially plays to my upholder habit of really relishing getting things done. So no one else in my immediate family is an upholder. And to be fair, they do get stuff done, but when I'm tired or stressed, my default upholder feels very strongly, why can't anybody else get stuff done? Well, I think one of the things we haven't touched on yet is that when we are tired or stressed or overwhelmed, our tendency becomes more pronounced. Mm-hmm. And so I'm aware of that. So that's part of one of the benefits of knowing this about myself is that I can then be aware of that as a parent for both myself, but also for my kids. So being aware of people's tendencies and having a better understanding of why some things might be challenging for them and why other things might be easy, that's a really big benefit. And it helps a lot in a family, especially in a family where your kids are a little bit older like mine and they're wanting to assert their independence. So when my husband or my children push back on something that I've suggested or asked, it's not necessarily that they're trying to annoy me. It's just part of their tendency. And so when I remember that, that helps keep us as a much more harmonious household. But as I said, I'm human. We're not perfect. And as an upholder, I absolutely relish order, structure, and routine, which has definitely impacted the way I parent. I take over doing a lot of those kind of structure and routine things. We do have a bit of a weekly schedule for managing the many extracurricular activities that occur before and after school. And we use a few different methods to keep everyone on track on those. So we have clear expectations written down, stuck up on the fridge, about what chores are to be completed and how frequently they need to be done. Now, again, I put it up there and it makes me feel happier knowing that I've got a plan for it, even if they don't actually do it.
But isn't it more supportive for you? And I think that that's quite important, that you need to do what is supportive for you, even if it's not necessarily, everybody's necessarily on board. Some things are just for you.
Absolutely. And I've realized that more recently when I was getting very frustrated about why they weren't reading the chore chart. Knowing my tendency has actually helped me consider how I phrase those questions or requests to my kids. So knowing that I'm an upholder and knowing that not very many people are upholders means that when I'm kind of navigating and negotiating, for example, when they've got friends over, it's much better for me to use an approach or a communication that appeals to all four tendencies. And that seems to work better than me defaulting to a classic upholder position, which pretty much to everyone else can sound a little bit bossy and a bit like, do this because that's the expectation or because I've asked you to.
Yeah.
Because I said so. And we all know that doesn't really vibe with most of us. But even as an upholder, I actually don't like people telling me to do stuff because I've said so, because I've got this, like, leave me alone. It's all under control.
Yes.
So that's kind of the upholder's rebellion is like, don't tell me what to do because I already have this under control.
Yeah. So two things I want to pick up on there. Do you know your kids' tendencies? And then I'd love for you to tell us about how you can appeal to all four tendencies at the same time. But just tell us, do you know your kids' tendencies? How do you know them?
Okay. So look, it's actually really tricky, but it does help to have a bit of an inkling of an idea, right? So my eldest is 15 and definitely in the teenage years, and the other is 11, but he's almost 12. And so with all the hormone shifts that are going on in both kids, then maybe their tendency is not as overtly at play. But I'm pretty sure, all that said, that my eldest is an obliger and the youngest is a questioner. And the way I worked that out was daily interactions. But more recently, I've noticed that the youngest, he's actually taken on the identity of a questioner. He's really proud to be a questioner. For the obliger, I worked out that what helped me kind of work it out was if I hinted around it or tried any of the other approaches, it didn't really work. But when I explicitly asked for a support or help in a very clear way, then he would do it. And it was very easy and straightforward, which was terrific for me because then I was like, well, if I ask him to do the dishes like we talked about, then generally he'll just get on and do it. Not immediately, but he will do it. For my younger child, the questioner, I always need to explain why doing something is important. And even then, unless he agrees with my reasoning and it aligns with his own views or internal expectations, he won't adhere to the external expectation, which, as I mentioned, he is super proud about. Like, he thinks that's hilarious. It's not very funny as a parent. But all that said, their personalities are still pretty fluent at this stage and their tendencies have shifted a little bit, but I'm pretty confident they are obliger and a questioner, which means in my house we have a full deck. So we have upholder, rebel, obliger and questioner. So on that note, Shelley, how about you? How about your boys? Do you have an idea of what their tendencies might be?
Yes, I agree that it's tricky to tell a child's tendency, especially, you know, and my boys are 8 and 5, so they're in the early stages of childhood. And I think there are a lot of other influences at play determining why children act. And so I think their tendency is probably established, but it might not influence their behavior as profoundly in childhood. My guess, because I also, through observation, and I love this book so much, so I observe and I categorize them. My guess is that I've got a fellow rebel and another questioner. So in our home, we've got the pairs. So my little rebel is an incredible artist. He'll do the most amazing drawings when he feels like it. But then if I ask him to do a drawing, like I'll ask him to do it for someone's birthday card or something like that, he'll resist. And even if it's just subtly, he'll be like, oh, I'm going to do something else now, I'll do it later. And even if he does do it, it's often not his best work. And yeah, I do recognize my part in bringing some perfectionist energy to the table. But because of the book, I've learned to work around this. So I keep an art portfolio, just a simple plastic folder that I use to file his artworks. And then when I want a nice picture for a birthday card or something special, I just go and grab it from that portfolio or even photocopy it onto some cardstock. And yeah, rather than putting him under the pressure and expectation of doing it in the moment. And this is just an example of how you can play to the strengths of your child's tendency rather than what I was doing of just putting this pressure on and raising expectations and then getting resistance. And of course, an upholder or an obliger child, I think, would probably be the complete opposite. I'm guessing if you had to say, oh, please do a beautiful card for Granny's for Mother's Day, they're going to bring the A game. But particularly with an obliger, you might not get these random masterpieces that I get from my rebel child if you don't specifically ask for them. And then I also just want to point out in terms of parenting is that a predictable, yet just a loose schedule for our days and weeks has been so helpful for both of my kids. Like you mentioned this in your household, right? But ironically, I find particularly for my little rebel. And this surprises me. And it's sometimes difficult for me as a rebel to keep a schedule and to lead that schedule in our house. That's why Garen is quite supportive there. But I find that schedule is actually really supportive for all of us as a family. And look, I'm actually with the two rebels. I'm not exactly sure why, but my theory lately is that it helps eliminate decision fatigue. And as a rebel, when a rebel needs to constantly be making decisions, they're also going to be seeing expectations around each of those decisions. And then they're going to like run a mile. So that loose schedule reduces some of those decision points and it gives some structure, even if it's structure to push against. So I think we can dive into decision fatigue in another episode because, Ro, you mentioned earlier that you tend to communicate in a way that appeals to all four tendencies, especially when talking to your kids and their friends. So I'd love to have a quick chat about that, about how we can all communicate in that way.
Yeah, for sure. I do want to just touch on that, what you've said, Shelley. I think there are merits, particularly for younger kids, about having like a schedule or a routine because it helps them feel safe and supported. And exactly as you've said, it gives them something to push against, but in a really secure and safe way. So back to your specific question, it's been a bit of an experiment, to be honest, because it's only been in the last few weeks that my youngest has self-identified as a questioner. And I do say self-identified because it's an internal expectation he's decided and therefore it's true. Whereas if I asked him to do the quiz all those years ago, he was like, nah. But also just on that, there's a bit of a side note. Gretchen shares in the book, most younger children are actually wired to appear as questioners, mostly because we're all probably pretty familiar with the classic why question. So when we're talking to really young kids, aiming to use explanation as much as possible works well. So kind of explaining why are we doing things, because most kids will benefit from that approach because it's helping make sense of the world around them, which means they're more likely to apply what you're asking them to do. So conversely, with my older kids, when my older boy has friends over, I tend to use clear, direct requests because obliges are, in fact, the most common tendency. So it makes sense to appeal to that tendency when communicating with a group. But appealing to all four tendencies can be a real winner when talking to a group or if you're making a request of someone and you aren't actually sure of their tendency. So communicating in a way that speaks to everybody is really beneficial in that instance. Gretchen actually says three key things that our communications absolutely need to have in order to work for all four tendencies. And those things are information, consequence, and choice. So again, that's information, consequence, and choice. And she actually includes a beautiful example in the book, which I love because as a dog mummy, it's about dogs and keeping dogs off a garden. I'll quote directly from the book and it says, dog urine kills plants and poop stinks. Please be kind and help us keep this area nice. Thank you. Now, I love that because the information, the consequences, and the choice are all very, very clear. And as parents, it's worth noting it's not actually a very lengthy message. And as I mentioned before, we can sometimes over-explain things, but this was actually a really clear, concise message and it worked well. So I really love that as a nice way to communicate to all four types of attendees.
Yes, I like that one too, because you've got the information, the consequences, and the choice. It's really clear. The questioners will get the information. They don't need a lot of information. And so they've got the information of, you know, that dog urine kills plants and poop stinks. Like, there's your information. And then the obligers, they're going to be ready to help. It's like, because you mentioned like, please be kind and help us keep this area nice. So it's like, oh, come help. I need your help. Obligers are going to like respond to that. And the upholders will generally follow rules anyway. And I also like that it presents the rebels with a choice. It also adds this part about being kind, which to me, that appeals to my identity. I like to think of myself as a kind person. So I'm going to follow that because I'm a kind person, not necessarily because someone told me to, but because I want to be a kind person. So yeah, but I like what you say about the length as well. I think it can be easy to over-explain, which for many kids means they just tune out.
Yes, exactly. My little questioner, in fact, as I said, he boasts about his selective listening. Drives me absolutely crazy.
Well, that's so funny because Garen also has an amazing ability to tune out audio. It's why he doesn't listen to podcasts or audiobooks. So maybe it's a questioner thing. Now, the other thing that I'm intrigued to talk about, particularly for obligers and parents of obligers, is this concept of obliger rebellion. So obligers are so great because they readily respond to the expectations of others. And in fact, in rereading this book, I realized obligers need accountability. And if our loved ones who are obligers ask for accountability, then really the right thing to do is to give them that accountability in some way. But the problem comes in is that when you're always doing something for someone else, and then also everyone starts realizing this and just expecting you to do all this stuff, then there's going to come a breaking point.
Yeah, exactly. So obliger rebellion occurs because so often, as you said, obligers end up actually feeling exploited, resentful, or even burned out. Because as Gretchen shares, when that occurs, and I'm going to quote again from the book, they may reach a point of obliger rebellion where they simply refuse to meet some expectations, often dramatically and without warning.
Ah, so they're getting in on the rebel acts because rebels are known for simply refusing to meet expectations.
Yeah, but actually I think for obligers, it comes more from being burnt out and not just as like a natural tendency. But I think you're right, as just like rebels, it can be a pattern of behavior for some obligers. But for others, it might just be like a one-time act. But it can also be triggered by meeting others' expectations that they don't find fulfilling. So because they've been asked to do something, they do it, but they're not actually enjoying it and they're not finding it fulfilling. So one of the examples in the book that resonated for me was where an obliger agrees to do something that they don't actually want to do. So if an obliger finds themselves in this situation too often, that can actually bring on obliger rebellion. So it's often compounded by the strengths of the obliger tendency. So that is, they think about others' needs and expectations all the time. And so they really can't understand how others aren't thinking considerately when making requests.
So they're assuming that like the other person has got their best interest at heart, but I can see how that would do it. I think obliger rebellion is definitely a form of self-protection to kind of go this far and no further, because you and I both have obliger leaning. So I think we can also empathize with the situation of being asked to do something that we didn't want to do, but then just like, because saying no is hard for all of us. Saying no can be hard. So how can our obliger friends and those like us who have obliger leanings avoid this obliger rebellion? Where I think, you know, I can just picture like someone lighting a match and throwing it behind them and like burning the whole place down.
Oh my gosh, yes. But you're right. Like, it's really hard to say no. And so I think the best way for both our obliger friends and people like you and me who have obliger leanings is to simply watch for the signs that resentment is building. And then speak up. Now, it's actually really hard to speak up as well. And it's very hard for obligers to say no. But in order to avoid obliger rebellion, which, to be honest, most of them actually don't really enjoy it because they're feeling burnt out and resentful and overwhelmed. They don't want to feel like that. So they need to learn to or practice saying no, and that is necessary to avoid feeling exploited. So what it might do to help our obliger friends is to remind themselves or remind yourself that if you agree to a request, then you're going to have to say no to another person's request because simply, mathematically, we cannot say yes to everyone. So you play into the strengths of the obliger tendency by shifting the obligation to another person. So in some instances, that can make saying no a little easier. So I'll give you a quick example. So if someone asks, can you drive my kid to this event, but you've already said yes to someone else, then it's quite easy for you to say no because you've made a promise to someone else. Or if you've promised to be at your child's recital, but your neighbour asks you, can you just stay home because I've got a parcel being delivered and I've got to go off to do this thing, can you be at home to do that? It's quite easy for you to say no in that instance because the person who you have made a commitment to, your child, actually you care more about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, so speak up and say no. And I'm also thinking about what you said earlier and perhaps for those around the obliger, so like the family and the friends and the colleagues, I think we need to be aware of the requests that we make of obligers too. Like as good human beings, the responsibility is shared. And just as the obliger needs to be aware and watch for these signs, I think the rest of us also need to be considerate of the requests we make and watch for signs of burnout, especially in our loved ones, and don't overburden our obliger friends and family.
Absolutely. I think it comes back to that point before about kindness and compassion and recognizing that when we make requests of anybody, if we come at it from a perspective of love, kindness, compassion, and caring, then hopefully through that lens, we will make better requests that are more aligned with ensuring that everybody comes out feeling okay at the end of it. Which on that note, I think it might be a great place for it to wrap up our episode because it is all about awareness of ourself and of others and knowing our own tendency and as a parent and spouse and how that assists with how we relate and connect with our loved ones. I actually think Gretchen says it best, of course, because it is her book. But she says, knowing about the four tendencies can help us to give people what they need, not what we would need. And then we can work together more harmoniously.
So true. And on that harmonious note, we'd love for you, the listeners, to add your voices to the mix. Have you read the four tendencies? Have you applied it in your family? Do you know your kids' tendencies? We'd love to connect. And so you can find us on Instagram. I'm Shelley Smith Creative on Instagram. And Ro, where can our listeners find you?
And I'm Rowena Mabbott on Instagram. So we'll be putting up a post on our Instagram feeds each time a podcast goes live. And you can leave us, either of us, a comment on that post. And that way we can continue the conversation.
And talking of conversation, we'd love it if you tell your friends about Two Booked Up. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And remember, please subscribe to the podcast in your podcast player. That's the best way to get all our future episodes.
You can also contact us through our website, Two Booked Up. That's TWOBookedUp.com. And that's where you can also find show notes from this episode and all the back catalogue of episodes, as well as all the future ones. Okay, that's all for this episode. In our next episode, we'll be shifting focus to how the four tendencies show up in our businesses and how you can harness your tendency strength in your workplace.
Oh, it's another juicy one, that's for sure. So join us for episode 3 of Two Booked Up.